Hey, Elliot.
Hey, Brian.
What's the talk at the table?
Today, we are sitting down with Grant Howitt, co-founder of Rowan Rook and Deckard, and designer behind beloved games from Honey Heist and Heart to Spire and the upcoming Hollows. Grant Howitt, welcome to the table. How are you doing?
Hello, I'm good. I am rejuvenated. Rejuvenated and slightly tired. I'm back from UKGE, so it's kind of like our biggest UK convention. And so we had a stellar weekend and got to meet lots and lots of people, and my knees have become sort of calcified oysters from standing up for the whole time. But my spirit is strong, but my body is pushing 40.
Well, we'll cut the jumping jack contest from this interview.
Oh my god! Thank you. I was really worried about it coming up. I'm still okay on the push ups and stuff.
Okay, cool.
We do have to keep the squats because that is part of the format. But we'll minimize.
Okay, thank you. Yeah. Light squats, please.
Light squats. Yeah, you don't have to go all the way down. Just any kind of lowering of the butt. That's what
any kind of descent.
Yeah, okay. Any descent is good.
Perfect.
So, Grant, we always like to, with these conversations, kind of set the table for our goal the conversation. That's actually the first time I've done that, but I liked it. And so the kind of main conversation we want to have with you is using Hollows and the current crowdfunder as a way in. We want to talk to you about how your team continues to innovate in TTRPGs and how you are managing growth in TTRPG publishing at Rowan Rook and Deckard. I think you guys have had a couple years of big growth and new games and kind of seeing how that's changed things over at the Rowan Rook and Deckard home base. Does that sound like
I'd like to talk about that. That sounds interesting.
Perfect. I think to start us off, just for anyone who hasn't yet seen Hollows, can you give us a quick rundown of what Hollows is?
Sure. So Hollows is our new thing. It's on Backerkit now. It is... We really wanted to make a game which had more of a mechanical crunch to it. And I think that like Spire, Heart, Honey Heist, the things you mentioned up at the top, they're very woolly, I suppose. And that's on purpose. And the idea is that combat and social and gambits and what have you can flow together smoothly. And with Hollows, we tried to do something different. We wanted to make a game about combat. And it took us 3 years because it was only about combat for a while. And I was like, well, this isn't very interesting. I'm not saying anything dangerously leftist with this. So now it's got this fascinating combat system, which maybe we'll chat a little bit more about later. But the overall idea is that you play broken, damaged people in a sort of fucked up 1860s England, even more fucked up than it was previously. Instead of gods, we have these things called malignancies, and they are finding the most broken and damaged and unpleasant people in the Isles and transforming their madness and their trauma into these parasite other worlds called Hollows. And you play someone who is so depressed they have superpowers, wielding weapons that hate you. You kick in the back doors of someone else's personal hell and go and murder their personal demons. It's rather exciting.
Hell yeah. Lots of stuff in there that we want to get into. My first question, though, before we get into a little bit of this crunch and these dice mechanics that you've made for this, was making a nat 20 a critical failure? Did that start as a joke?
So, no, like, I really like roll under systems. I think, like the Black Hack and Into the Odd or Electric Bastion Land, its bigger cousin, I think that roll under makes a lot more sense rather than, okay, so you've got a stat of 18. Now, you'll never look at that ever again. That gives you +4 to the roll. And you're looking to hit a number. Is like there's an awful lot of chat between the GM and the player there, and you don't really know what you're doing. So roll under, from a rules light perspective, works really well. However, we are genetically predispositioned to want dice roll high number. So it does feel weird when there's a 20 and it's like, oh no, that's the worst thing that could have happened, lads.
I do want to start because recently we've been playing on My First Dungeon a lot of very narrative, like much more narrative games, less crunchy games. And it has been making me yearn a little bit for a bit of crunch.
Yeah. We want a game where you could do a flank. That's our secret.
Honestly, kind of, yeah.
Yeah, a little bit.
I was coming into this interview, I was rereading the playtest, the quick start for Hollows, and just looking at this like lock-on combat system, I was thinking, this will be great for an actual play. Like, it works well in an audio space. But also, boy, howdy, do I want to talk about positioning in a fight. That sounds incredibly fun.
So it's inspired by primarily MMOs. The idea being that, so my co-author Chris, we used to play Secret World together, along with Maz, actually, the other third founder of Roanoke and Deckard. We used to play back in 2013, I think, 2014. And Chris would carry us, the three of us, through a five-man dungeon. Chris likes playing a healer. I think the phrase is bottoming from the top. Topping from the bottom, that's the phrase, sorry. So Chris plays a long-suffering healer. And it was when we were playing that I learned how to tank. And I approach every computer game by running as hard as I can forward to find the exciting thing. And if there's something behind me, I'll deal with that later. And as a tank, that's actually not too bad a way of going into things. If you find the biggest thing in the room and run at it, you're generally doing the right thing. So I really enjoyed that. And Maz was DPS because they're very good at Guitar Hero. And so it's basically the same thing.
Sure.
And so... We played this and I found the idea of tanking and like pulling aggro and positioning attacks come away from you. So like Secret World had quite a good line in big area attacks on bosses. And I know that Final Fantasy 14, which I've never played, but Maz plays a lot of, does similar things with stand here, don't stand here, that sort of thing. So tanking has a real impact on that. And then any game which we played which attempted to recreate this didn't work. The challenge being that once you're on a map, there are a lot of variables to work out in terms of positioning, and especially like, and if you're not on a map, if you're just doing it in Theatre of the Mind, it's incredibly woolly. And I'm reminded of 13th Age, one of my favorite games, and I think the Kickstarter is just ending actually for the second edition. In 3.5, if you had a spear, it had range of 10 foot, so you could attack from behind, except it was a bit awkward and no one really bothered doing it ever. And so for that to work, you had to have be able to measure 10 foot in abstract space. And 13th Age didn't do any of that. It had much more abstract distances. And so you took a feat, which was do something tricky with the spear once per fight, which recreates, like, it abstracts out the idea of, oh, I'll get into the position and I'll do the things. Like, you just want to feel clever because you can reach. And so with Hollows, what we tried to do was abstract as much of the minutiae out of it to get down to what was interesting. And so the deal being, and as Brian called it earlier, lock on targeting, the baddie in the middle of the map, and it's always a boss fight. We've got a modified horde mode, which simply does not work at the moment, but it might reach the final edition. Every fight's a boss fight, and the boss is always at the center of the grid, and they don't go anywhere. And we have right flank, left flank, front, rear, and then ranged versions of those, and support, which represents breaking line of sight and hurriedly reloading or strapping on bandages or what have you. And that's all the places you can be in a fight. Terrain is something which you do rather than a place you are. So there's a limited amount of terrain tokens, which we put on the table, and then you roll to claim terrain. You get a benefit if you claim the same terrain as someone as the area you're in. And so like there's a narrative weight to it there where you can say, right, I'm going to take position behind this gravestone. And then the other guy can say, oh, cool, I'll hide behind it too. It's easier for them. And so there's one of the biggest challenges was taking the abstraction where an entity doesn't move, and if in the fiction you want them to move, you have to move the players around them. That was a real challenge, and that was really, I think, what a lot of the 3-year development was getting towards, was working out how much we can boil this down and then effectively communicate it to players so they can make an interesting tactical decision, but we're not sort of like measure, oh, it's 35 foot, so am I behind the entity or am I to the side of the entity? No, it's never unclear where you are or what you're doing. And the only times which we sort of skew into that is when it would take more than 3 sentences to explain some wheedling edge case rule. So we just sort of rely on the GM for that. So we might say, like, move a player character clockwise around the grid. And it doesn't quite line up because the pieces don't line up. And so you can make the GM is like, oh, well, they can't, clockwise, they'll go there. And so for those awkward bits or like describing what flanking actually means, turns out there's a reason why the combat chapter in D&D was so fucking long. Because it's awkward to describe these things in terms which can be, you know, disseminated and used in an almost competitive fashion. But it's an interesting thing, and it opens up an interesting design space. And I think in addition to Hollows, because like we put out generally an SRD or a toolbox of all of our games, because we really want to encourage people to make their own stuff. And I'm really interested to see what else we can do with a system which, you're fighting one big guy, and two, where you're standing relative to him matters. Can run, because I really want to see it, and I obviously I really want to see it do Hollows because I've spent a long time writing that. But I really want to see like five guys with explosives fighting a mech.
Mm. Oh, sure.
Right,
sure,
like climbing it and strapping mines on the back of it and blowing it up. Oh, like Titanfall? Oh.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
This system really hits a great spot for me because it operates in between banded ranges, which are always feel unsatisfying to me, but they are so much easier to navigate.
Like near, far, distant.
Yeah, far, close, remote, which I like because they work really well, especially when you're playing remotely. Like it's very easy to conceptualize. But there is something about like tactical grid that scratches a certain itch, but it does require you to be at the same table. It requires a little more crunch to it that maybe not everyone gets involved in. This is that perfect middle ground of like, you can still make those decisions that are like very tactical and crunchy and like really have a gamesmanship to them. But I could easily do this remotely or like via or like for a podcast because it's just complex enough that you can still keep it in your mind and still find a satisfaction of being able to do those kind of ticky-tacky tactical moves rather than just strategic moves.
And the tactics as well, which we try to encourage, like Hollows is really, really hard if you don't work together. Like it's like if everyone makes a lone wolf and walks in, it's a very swingy game, and we didn't do that on purpose, but we kept it because we liked it, because it makes player character deaths like really unglorious, I suppose would be the word. Inglorious? I don't know what the opposite of glorious is. But when a player character dies, it's almost always like, pat down. It's horrible.
The inglorious death and the lock-on boss is always in the center feels very Souls-like to me, which
absolutely,
is like another one of the influences that you guys cite.
Yeah. Bloodborne especially.
The visuals, 100%. It feels like many people have tried to emulate the Souls-like experience in tabletop. And there's a couple of things you said here of like the lock-on mechanics. Like when you're playing Soul, like locking on is half the battle. Like as you're like moving around, you're not really concerned with terrain. Why for you was this like this the mechanic that like emulated that Souls-like experience? Or are you a Souls-like fan?
Oh, absolutely. Yes. General? I'm not very good at them.
No, me neither, but I like them.
No one's good at them.
No, some people
are good at them.
I completed Dark Souls 1 a couple of years after it came out, and the only way I could do that was to have my partner Maz sat on the sofa next to me as effectively control, and so Maz would have one or two walkthroughs up live, and so like I walked into Sen's fortress and Maz would be like, okay, there's a snake man on your left, and I'd fucking parry, rolling ball on your right, roll out the way, and it was pretty slick. And you know, when it worked that one time, I very much enjoyed that. I've played all the others. I thought Bloodborne was gorgeous. I made a faith build in Elden Ring, so I can't finish the game. And there is a like the idea of here is a horrible thing that you have to get good at really resonated for us. And also the way like the idea of death as a learning experience and a way in which you grow and change. Death in, say, Heart or Spire is supposed to be really final. And the idea is that for both of those games, it's about giving your life dearly or dying in an important way, in a way that matters. And in this, when you die, your corruption ticks up, so you get weird stuff going on with you as whatever these sort of huge elemental forces start ravaging your paltry human body. But the idea that you get a total party wipe and then wake back up in the refuge and go back out and try again. And like we've got mechanics for, we've had a total party wipe. Okay, we need to balance the monster a little bit. So we're going to spend our refuge actions researching and coming up with a way to debuff the monster a little bit. And that ties back into the fiction. So it's like that's easier the more you've been investigating and that sort of thing. That ties back into, I think, the ideas of masculinity, which the game plays with, and the sort of the inherent stoicism of it, and the idea that, oh, I'll just keep trudging on. It's also the game which Chris and I wrote after therapy rather than before. So in this one, you can't die, as opposed to Spire and Heart, which are all about dying. Or Goblin Quest, which is all about dying, which was the first game I wrote 14 years ago. So in terms of the Soulsborne stuff, I think that for the last 10 years, 15 years, they've been a huge influence on everything, not just from video games, but to TV and to tabletop games as well. And a lot of games have tried, and I'm not saying that like, we've got the perfect Soulsborne experience, but I think it's a damn sight closer than an awful lot of even like officially branded products. Because we've spent a great deal of time trying to make combat tick along and trying to make it fast. And the idea of having, like, I think it's the positioning, honestly. And I think it's the fact that you're always moving. You're effectively, you can't help but strafe. You can't help but circle strafe in Hollows. And I think the idea of, like, rather than being on a grid and, like, oh, am I measuring? Am I being caught? It's like, it's very defined. Like, oh, no, this guy's going to hit me if I stand here. But if I roll over here, he's not going to hit me. And I think that's sort of, like, that almost... It's a split second reaction. We've managed to sort of maybe abstract away a little bit, but also the bleakness of it and the idea of like there is this bleak world and you're attempting to do a tiny little thing which might make it a little bit better, and the way that you're all fucked up little men. It evokes a lot of the FromSoft oeuvre, let's say.
Going into this game, why was toxic masculinity the thing that you wanted to examine?
Therapy again. So we had quite a few drafts of it, and the first ever draft we had of Hollows, it was a game called, it was the, oh, was it the Witches of Sumpsuckle Holler? It was the Swamp Witches of Sumpsuckle Holler, which was a game pitched to Hearty Dice Friends, actually, our very old podcast, Chris and I stopped doing Hearty Dice Friends a couple of years ago, but we used to get game pitches sent in, and someone just sent in that title. And we thought, that'd be fun. What about a game where you hunt wet ghosts?
All right.
Set in the bayou or what have you. And Chris has been playing an awful lot of Hunt Showdown, which this game also evokes. And so the first draft was like Deep South America, backwards magic, crocodiles, that sort of thing. And the more we got towards that, I was like, that's not my story. I can't tell that. I'm very English. I'm very white. And I don't feel like I can authentically tell that story. And so we knocked about with a few settings. I think there was one where 2-3 years ago, it would be that they mined all the magic out of the world. And so now, they mined the last clean magic 50 years ago, and now all the magic we have is dirty. And then that sort of builds up in pockets called Hollows. And it's, it's a climate catastrophe analog, basically. I played with that for a bit, but I think the real turning point for me was the idea of I played Disco Elysium, and the way that Disco Elysium represents skills absolutely fascinated me, because they are all inherent to your body. They're all like made out of meat. It's not like, oh, I've learned how to pick a lock. It's how quickly and accurately my fingers can move. And the way in which they all speak to you and they lie and they contradict each other really captivated me, because it's all effectively sideline stuff, but it's a game with, what is it, 16 narrators? You know, it's fascinating. And it's far too clever for me to finish Disco Elysium. Like, I keep meaning to go back to it, but it's so good I get jealous and stop.
Yeah, I'm the same way.
I've had those experiences.
Good. Yeah, it's so clever. Exhausting. But we played that and we were sort of going back and forth, and like we realized that we had the idea of, like, we used to have individual weapons rather than these iconic things. And so I think we had it was kitchen knife and combat knife, which was an upgrade of the kitchen knife, and then something like black iron knife or trench knife, which was something which, like, it got more and more specific as you went down and more professional, as it were. We had a bunch of stats going around for them. It wasn't quite resonating. The setting wasn't quite there. It was half D&D, and it was like sort of like where's it set and what are we doing? Sort of tooled around with the North of England setting, because I thought that was interestingly bleak, and I was moving up to the North of England quite soon at the time. And we had the idea to boil down the weapons to these what at the time 11 iconic things. And rather than being simply like a pistol which you have, it is a facet of the idea of pistols. It is all the memories of a bludgeon distilled into a stick that you hit people with. And so once we got to there, there was a sense that I was like, well, okay, I want to give these weapons a voice. Because I really like the idea of your gun talking to you is a common righteous avenger lunatic trope. And so I want to sort of play with that. And then I started writing as the weapons. And I think it was the spear. I started writing as the spear first. And the spear is the idea that this world wants to hurt you. There is us and there is them. There is a line between us and them. And over that line crosses the spear. And the idea that the spear is an expression of keeping bad things away from stuff that's yours. And then, and like the fear inherent in that. And the sort of the backs to the wall sort of thing, the cornered rat. And so took that and was like, oh, okay, that's interesting. Right, what does the shotgun feel? What's a shotgun about? And the idea that from that, the toxic masculinity stuff and toxic behaviors in general fell out of that. Like the spear is fear of outsiders. And that is traditionally viewed as a xenophobia could very much be put forward as a toxic masculine trait because it works and it's rewarded when it's done by men confidently. And so going through all of these and like the shotgun is absolute split second violence and suicidal ideation. And the idea that like, well, what if I could hurt my way out of this, which is as a man, whose body has been riddled with testosterone almost uselessly for the last 37 years. There's that bright flash of like flip the table, kick this guy in the face. It's like, I can't kick a guy in the face. I work behind a typewriter. I've got the lithe body of a games designer. I can't fight, but my body wants to fight. And so the idea of these weapons talking to you rose out of that. And then from there, we developed the idea of these malignancies. And the malignancies we really wanted not to have as, I'm going to put this, they're not evil. Because no one wakes up in the morning and decides to be evil. Everyone thinks they're doing the right thing. Everyone's justifying all their actions. Or they're not, and they're struggling with that. And that's kind of part of the fun and why you might become a hollow. So like rather than have greed, we had hunger. And we wanted to have the idea that every single malignancy in small amounts, when it's not become toxic, is sensible, is a good thing to have. You need to be hungry. You need to eat. Grief is another one. You need to grieve. You need to be able to commemorate and let go and compartmentalize your life into time before the loss and time after the loss. But then what if you don't do that? So the malignancies we have are fury, fear, grief, hunger, pride, and dominion. And the idea being that all of these things are fundamentally not bad. There are ways in which we can use these which are useful and healthy to ourselves and society. But if we push them too far, that's when things go wrong. And I think like once the weapons and the malignancies came together, and I was like, oh, can we make about the fall of empire as well, Chris? He's like, yeah, sure, whatever. Because we both really like the mid-1800s, what weaponry was doing at that point is really, really works for us because you've got like you're just getting to the point where weapons are becoming reliable, but they're still weird. Sure. And so like you're looking at like rolling block rifles or like the Colt Navy where you're making your own bullets and it's this enormous shooting iron thing and like only maybe one in three of the shots actually fires, and they're coming out of the realm of cannon and artillery into something which a person might have privately or what have you. And so all those answers.
So all that.
Rom-Com Drama Bomb is a three-player, GM-less, asymmetrical TTRPG about me-cutes and mayhem. In this 90-minute timed game, you'll play as two people who shouldn't fall in love and the evil villain who will stop at nothing to make sure they do. Rom-Com Drama Bomb is now available. You can grab it digitally at moreblueberries.itch.io/romcom. Or you can grab a physical book, the pinkest book you've ever seen, at moreblueberries.shop/romcom. Check it out and happy rom-comming. Rom-comming? I don't know. Drama bombing?
Speak into the void. You never know who may be listening. In the Emmy award-winning Void 1680 AM, you take on the role of a late-night radio DJ. Use a standard poker deck and a six-sided die to build your playlist, interact with callers, and assemble a show that expresses something about why you love the music that you do. Void 1680 AM includes rules for single session and ongoing play, so you can develop the relationships of your DJ with your callers over time. You can even join the growing community of affiliate DJs whose shows are broadcast live on air and on YouTube. Shop Void 1680 AM now at bannerless.games/shop and take 20% off your order with promo code DUNGEON. Again, that's 20% off your order with promo code DUNGEON.
I'm curious kind of where, you know, where does that journey go for players? Like, they're grappling with these aspects of toxic masculinity and their weapons. Is that a journey that a player can expect to, like, overcome in some way? Or does it take the Souls-like approach of, like, you're a fucked up guy at the beginning and you're a fucked up guy at the end?
So it's a bit more personal than Souls. We're not giving people, like, blank characters, which were, like just ciphers. So, like, there's three sort of cosmic parts to a character outside of the mundane. There's your weapons, the malignancy that's chosen you, and something we call your seed. And the seed is the worst day of your life and the reason why that you're able to go into hollows and why when you die you will become a hollow. Basically, you become a dungeon for the other players to fight through, which is quite good fun. But as you die and as you start messing around with supernatural things, spending more time in hollows and talking to effigies of the malignancies, your corruption ticks up. And then I think it's every 10 you roll on a table and one of those three things makes its presence known. And we have wired those all into the combat, basically, or like to the we didn't want to put that stuff into downtime, because although while it definitely will be in downtime, one thing which we find quite challenging is when the bits of a game don't play together. And so something happens over here and something happens over here and it doesn't really matter. And so we tried to have, so for example, the seed is probably my favorite one of these, because it's every character's, you know, tragic backstory. Low results on that are the worst day of your life shows up in someone else's personal hell and makes everything harder for everyone else. And so I think the example we have is if you accidentally set a raging mob of villagers on the town witch and they tore it to shreds. When the first time you roll that, a raging mob of villagers from your town kicks apart the doors of the place you're in, like the first scene in a dreamy film, Leonardo DiCaprio, Inception. And then the second time it gets a bit more dangerous, and then the third time the witch is there and she's riding the entity, she's riding the boss, and makes the boss more dangerous, or she's enchanted it somehow. And we wanted to take the ideas of, like, here's your backstory, and then really, like, have them follow you around. Similarly, in terms of the weapons, we wanted to have every time you roll something on the weapon, an emissary, an effigy of the weapon shows up, and this is a humanoid manifestation of the gun you have, arrives and taunts you and speaks to you and then does something unpleasant to your stats, basically. So again, it all feeds back in. I find that programming an arc into games is, I've tried to do it. I think Heart has arcs programmed into it, and I certainly think that, like, the way in which we developed Die, Kieran Gillen's game, that's the thing, there's definitely arcs already in it, but what we needed to do was tell him how to teach people how to do it. And I've got a lot of time for that in games. I don't think Hollows is that. I think Hollows is primarily a here are some horrible things that are happening to you. They'll be much more personal than Dark Souls. They'll intermingle, and it's more about how I put this. If you put a bunch of good role players in a room, they'll do an arc,
right?
And I think it's enabling that space and trying to give people and GMs the space to be creative and work in very broad allegories. The idea being that each hollow is itself kind of a ghost story. This trauma has done something to this person at the center of it. And then everything you view is, it's their mind palace, basically, which you walk through and you're tackling their own stuff. So there's an exploration around that. And I think that by placing people around each other and forcing them to rely on each other, there's a measure of support, there's a measure of character arcs there which will develop. And the two end results you have are either you manage to fight enough monsters to retire, and when you retire you never get to come back to the real world or the Hollow ever again, and you live effectively, you sort of imprison yourself in the Refuge, which is kind of like the Firelink shrine or an interdimensional boys club. You either imprison yourself there forever or you become a Hollow. And there's not both endings are absolutely terrifying. And like in terms of campaign, we envisage it going for probably about 6 Hollows in a campaign. And it would be either like, it would be mission led by a faction. So you pick a faction that you found interesting and then work for them. Or you might say, I want to try and clear out this area or push back the malignancies in this area. And so you'd examine how that works. I will say the other one thing I'm really proud of in terms of the downtime system, in terms of like describing things that have happened when you're not in a Hollow, because we didn't want to get bogged down with like faffing about and not playing the game. And so the higher your corruption, and this is speaking very heavily to my own depression, the higher your corruption, the less you can remember of the last month. Because it takes it from you. And when you're in the Hollow, it's the cut and thrust of combat and you're dying over and over and it's exciting and you're alive. And when you're in the Refuge, it's you and your friends, and it's this homosocial space that you've built, and it's precious to you and it's absolutely paramount. But outside of that, outside of the pub or a fight, you don't exist. And so like by the time you hit 150 corruption, you can remember a moment out of a month. And then in that moment out of a month, what are you doing to make the world better? Or are you spending it with your what remains of your family? Or are you going on a pilgrimage for the Garden Church or what have you? And so like there's definitely room to roleplay. There's definitely arcs, but I think we're hoping it will arise more out of the fiction than anything we've programmed in.
I do always love when, and I think Thronework and Deckard's games especially do this amazingly, in that you give the players so much. Like, I feel like the hardest thing when you're making a character in a lot of role-playing games is you get all these stats and you kind of sit down at the table and you've got to be like, what are they all about? Like, what's their thing? And in a game like this, or a game like Hard or Spire or Die, you're given so much that not only does it make the GM's job easier, it makes the player's job easier. Like, you don't have to be a, you know, great role player or have like a super vibrant imagination in order to get to the point that you want to get to. Like, you can get to the amazing story even if you are not practiced in, you know, this type of play.
I think like part of the reason why the characters resonate so well, why people are quite easy for people to get into them, is that in Heart and Spire, our character classes are fucking weird. And like we don't have the closest we've got is in Spire, there's a character called the Firebrand, who is kind of like a default revolutionary. And we wrote them last out of all the characters because I was like, oh, I want something with a bit more exciting, a bit sort of, we should have a revolutionary class, right? And so I wrote them last. And the reason why, like, they're very popular, and we managed to tie them into the idea of the populace as God. And so they're clerics of effectively workers' unions. That works really well, but they're not from anywhere. And every other class is from somewhere. Every other class has a base they operate from, as it were, or like somewhere they could be called back to. And it ties them back into the city. And so that really, I think, like by either cementing them to the city or in Heart, giving you something like, oh, I've replaced all my organs with bees. Oh, I make power armor out of trains. Oh, I'm so in debt to the goddess of debt that I've gone out the other side and now I work for her. Like, you don't have to try really hard to come up with something interesting because the core character is so weird. You can play that and you can play it straight. If you play a D&D character straight, nothing happens. But you're already so strange and you're in a strange place and you're desperately trying to cling to like just an ounce of humanity that I think that falls out. I think also in terms of like making characters, one of our core tenets that we have here, I used to have them written up on the wall next to me, was, and I quote, fucking awesome powers you just have to have.
I was literally about to say to you that, like, I feel like one of the strengths of your and Chris's games is you guys make these shopping lists in your games of the most delicious little goodies that I want to just, like, you know, I can't choose. I go to make a character and it's like, oh, but this and this and this. And that is such a... that is such makes for such a delightful character creation experience, and then also such a delightful play experience when you get to lean into that thing that you decided to pick off the shopping list. And then when you get to go back into that list, the thing you get next time, it's just, I guess that's just really a compliment to your writing. I don't have a question in there, but yeah.
And like, well, like I will say in terms of Hollows as well, we've tried to, so one of the things which I really enjoyed for a couple of years was theory crafting. Cause like my first proper role-playing game I got into was D&D 3.5. I dallied about with free games off the internet before that, but the first book I had to read was Hunter the Reckoning, which was a real baptism of fire. But the first role-playing game I played, I think, probably was 3.5. And so much of that, especially like around 2005, 2006, was the idea that you go onto a forum and you'd share your builds with each other. And like Pathfinder still does a great deal of that. I think they definitely made an effort to pull it like to lose that in fourth and fifth, and to have like, well, it's like you can make pretty much whatever choice you like and the character will still work fine, but you're not going to optimize it to crazy degrees. But 3.5, like a starting character with from just PHB only could theoretically walk into a room and go, "Gentlemen," and then roll +23 on diplomacy. And rules as written, you could talk your way out of any fight. A level 7 ranger could shoot an arrow, tie a rope to it, stick it in a cloud, and then run up that rope with a successful balance check. And the idea of sort of like coming up with these fucking ridiculous things that your character can do, that is not in any way a character per se. Like they're just a number of outputs which are mashing together interestingly, which means that there's this huge, interesting, and quite playful and satisfying space around theory crafting, which never makes it to the table because it's not any fun to do on the table. And so what we want to do is take the idea, again, to take inspiration from video games, to tie into those fucking awesome powers you just have to have. And please forgive me for using the word awesome. It was a few years ago. The way that leveling up works in Hollows is that you get, when you start, you have one ability from each weapon. And there's tier 1 abilities are useful and kind of let you do a thing and play the class. And then tier 2 abilities get a bit more interesting, and tier 3 break the game in half and do something really odd and like completely ignore one section of the rules or invert it or what have you. And the idea that like you're not necessarily getting more powerful, you're getting more options, like there's more you can do. And then the way that leveling up works, you have 2 from there, and every boss you kill, you get a new ability from either of your weapons. Pick it, add it on your character, go, let's go. And so like at the end of the first fight, you are theoretically 50% more powerful than you were before. And then at the end of a hollow, when you fight the Lord and close the hollow and seal the rift, you pick one of those abilities which you've chosen over the course of the hollow and bake it into your character. So you keep it. And then all the others go. And so this means that you get this ramp in power through every hollow. But also it means that you can try out some builds. And you can go, oh, that's interesting. Oh, what if I take that? And you can, if you've baked in an ability, but you swapped your weapons, you can keep the ability. So you can do, like, again, which we learned from the Secret World, the idea of like, well, okay, well, I'm going to spend maybe 3 weeks playing assault rifle so I can get this one heal, which doesn't need an assault rifle, but I've got this passive, and then I can roll back out and use my sledgehammer. And we wanted to take the idea of, oh, this will be good. Oh, we can mix together and do that. And that's, I think, one of the things which we wanted to talk about with the idea of positive masculinity is the idea that teamwork is absolutely required. I think I said half of this earlier, then lost my point. If you make lone wolves and go into hollows on your own, you die because you simply are not survivable enough to survive getting hit by an entity maybe twice if they know what they're doing. However, if you work together at all, it can actually be too easy. And we really wanted that because I'll take too easy over too hard, especially if it's an hour to play through a fight. And the GM can always fudge it if they want to. But it feels great when it's like, right, I'm going to... And also, like, we've fudged it so, like, initiative works in bands rather than a strict order. So if you're in a band, you can go whenever you want within that band. So it's like, well, I'll rush forward, which means I will... And then I'll guard in here, which brings up my resolve to a respectable area. But when I guard in here, that means an ally in my area gets to make a free movement action. So you get to run back over there away from me. And then when you're in his zone, you both reload at the end of your turn. And so it's about queuing up this interesting stuff, which, oh, it's infuriating to play against as the GM with these players with their shit-eating grins. And they're like, no, you can't heal.
There is nothing better in like a board game or in like if you play Magic the Gathering or something when your like your engine starts going where like now you your first turn you do one thing and it does one thing. By turn three or four, that one thing now does four or five things because you've like chained them together. Like having that satisfying moment of like tactical awareness and teamwork is the thing that I kind of miss sometimes from more like more narrative based games or things that are like looking at, you know, banded ranges or something. Because there's a chance where it kind of becomes just like a block of hit points hitting another block of hit points, just not as tactically. I really like that extra little tidbit. I'm just gassing you up. I'm excited.
Thank you. No, I'm excited.
It's another aspect that feels very Souls-like of like, not that Souls-likes are impossible alone, but it's a common experience of Souls-like players to like have that one boss where you're like, no, I am quitting this game over this boss. But then you bring a friend in, you know, and the two of you can take it down way easier. It's like, it's such, and it's satisfying when you do it, even if it feels like less hard than like a Souls-like quote unquote is supposed to be. I'm doing aggressive air quotes as I say this.
I believe this may be apocryphal, but like I believe the idea behind Souls games is that you're supposed to cheat. That there's no cheesy play. There's no if you're doing cheesy stuff in PvP, whatever. Not like I don't do PvP. That doesn't interest me. And I turn that bit off basically. But the idea that you're supposed to read through the wiki, and if you're not reading through the wiki, then people are sharing messages with you, and you're watching how they died, and you're summoning them to help. You're like, this is not you playing alone. Despite the fact that it's almost always this really bleak experience, especially especially in Dark Souls games, where there's this like miles and miles of nothing, and everything's built for someone three times your height, and you're not supposed to be here. And the idea of like having like this glimmer of hope, and you know, praise the sun, like the Knight Solaire is positive masculinity for me. Like he loves staring directly at the sun unprotected for hours at a time. And isn't that something we can all aspire to?
I do like the idea of a game that wants you to cheat. There was a time I got really into text adventure games, and like Zork was like the original Zork or Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy were games that I don't think anyone got through without looking at a manual, because especially Zork, like, if you didn't have a map in front of you, you couldn't conceptualize where you were supposed to go or what it was. And it was fun to get as far as you could and then eventually go into, you know, one of the... And they even made that part of the game when it came out. It's like included in the box of the game would be the manual of how you play. And you could go into it at your leisure. Like whenever you get stuck, great, there's a thing here. And there's a fun relationship there of like trying as hard as I can and then being like, okay, let's play through. Let's get past this part.
Broadly, I think that any relation, like, it's traditionally viewed the relationship between the players and the GM as like the players are these mewling weaklings, and the GM is some sort of benevolent, maybe malevolent god who sits above them and hands down punishments and rewards as they see fit. And it is nothing like that in actuality. This is a switch relationship, and both sides are flipping around because the GM has absolute power. But that's only because the players let them. If the players say, no, I don't want to do this at any point, then all your authority's gone. It's absolutely gone. And so it's this play back and forth between, I'm going to reward you, I'm going to hurt you, you've done the right thing, you've done the wrong thing. And then also from the players being like, oh yeah, you know what? Fuck you. And doing something absolutely, absolutely devastating, especially in a game like Hollows, where, you know, the numbers matter and the positioning matters and the actual like, oh, do I defeat them this round or next round matters, as opposed to being a bag of hit points. And so it's this, it's not adversarial. It's like any fight between Angelina Jolie and Brad Pitt in Mr. and Mrs. Smith, where you're flirting while you're fighting. Because you've come here to have this fight, but you're having a great time with it. But oh, don't you hit me, I'll hit you back. And it's Alex, oh God, what's her surname? Bloody hell. Wrote for the Queen.
Alex Roberts.
Roberts, I had Smith, which is different from that. Sorry, Alex. Alex and I wrote this game called Death Was the Only Road Out of Town, which is a one-page game, which is 2 pages long, so I got excited. The idea we had was we wanted to write a game, like if Paranoia is Dom Sub, we wanted a Switch game. We wanted to play around with that. And so it is a game where the GM is encouraged to be absolutely horrific to the players, and like body horror, all sorts of nightmare shit going on. It's like a dream space. None of it makes sense. And also, if you ever mention you're in a dream, you get really hurt. So you have to pretend that you don't know. But players accrue points when they roll the double on a dice. And you can spend those points to do things like, let's say the GM says, okay, a mob of goons pull up in a car. You slide forward 4 points. No, I don't. And like you get up to 7 and you'd be like, shut the fuck up, I'm the GM now. And you take over for 5 minutes and run the story. And so like it's carefully measured out and you have the thing. So there's still game mechanics there. But that power play is really fun. It's intoxicating.
So as we kind of near a close, want to shift gears a little bit towards sort of this journey that Hollows has taken and simultaneously the journey that Roan Rook and Deckard has taken along with it. Like you called out 3 years of development, pre-therapy, post-therapy. I'm seeing a parallel. We recently talked with Jay Dragon, which that interview will actually come out after this interview. We had this great conversation with Jay about how making Yuzeba's Bed and Breakfast like was this journey, and that like over time, really Possum Creek went on a journey that was very akin to the bed and breakfast in the fiction. And I'm curious, like, do you feel an emotional parallel to the development of this game? Does that happen with you with multiple games? And like, kind of where is Roan Rook and Deckard on that journey?
I don't know what you could mean by that.
Grant is holding two axes for our listening audience.
I just happened to have them.
I'm going to leave that shuffling sound in just because it's so good.
It's like I've got them buried in about, I'm going to say, 60 Games Workshop sprues just in a pile.
But let's be clear, you didn't get up.
No, arms reach. Yeah, absolutely. It's been pretty exciting actually. It's been stellar. We started off back in 2017 as me, Chris, and Maz. We'd done two Kickstarters, and it turns out the tax on Kickstarter at that point, and I believe still true, the money is taxed as income, which it is not, because you still got to make the book and send the book out. So like I think I lost about a third of the money I got through Goblin Quest to tax, just because we didn't sync it up right. And so we decided to incorporate, and that was good. We wrote Spire, and Spire was was our first stab at doing something which had more setting in, and that went down really well. And the setting came across, and people loved the setting. And so we did Heart, and that was about the same. You know, we're doing much more elaborate, much more in-depth books as compared to our earlier work, which also we could sell more of, which means we could make money, which means we didn't starve to death. We had Zach Cox came on board as producer, and Minerva McJander, who used to run UFO Press, like Legacy, Void Art Symphony, a designer in her own right, but she does layout for us now. Well, hopefully we're going to get to write some games soon. We blundered along for a while. We worked it out. We figured this is all good. And then with that pandemic, which really put a dent in things in terms of progression, especially like breaking America was quite hard because we weren't legally allowed to travel there for 18 months. But it was when Matt Sanders came on board. So Matt Sanders is our con guy and also deals with distributors and sort of like the big business end of things. Matt Sanders is the friendliest and therefore most powerful man in role-playing games, and I am terrified of having him as an enemy. So he works for us, and he's a professional, friendly person. And he and Maz, the other founder, aside from me and Chris, they went off to Gamma in America, which is the Game Something Makers Association affair. So it's very business to business. It's the sort of thing which I think I'd come out in fucking hives if I went anywhere near. It's simply not my scene. But Maz came back, and they were fired up, and they were ready, because they'd just quit their job to work full time with Roan Rook and Deckard. And it was fairly fraught because like we moved out of London, they took a fairly sizable pay cut to do so, but they didn't want to be in the corporate world anymore, and they wanted to do something which they were passionate about and effectively field a small team, which is what they're good at. They've put together like small teams and then small teams of people who manage massive teams. That's what they've done professionally for the last 20 years. And so if we'd hired them from outside, there is no way we could afford my spouse. Absolutely not. We couldn't stretch their day rate. But they came on board and they came back from Gamma, and we realized that there was this huge opportunity to get games out to people, to find a way to help people tell stories and make games, and effectively to guide them around the worlds which we're inventing, and started talking about distribution, started talking about all the writers are actually doing a bunch of management now, so could we bring on some producers to tackle that bit, and the strategy, so we can sort of go back. And we had this one sort of very strange meeting where we all sort of stared at each other and we're like, well, we're going to need to double the size of the company, but yeah, actually we can afford to do this. And it was tremendous. We brought on CJ, who runs marketing and customer service for us, and also Chan and Elaine, Chan Evans and Elaine Lithgow, who are both ex-Cubicle 7 as producers. And it kind of dawned on me, and it feels boastful to say this. It feels very un-British of me to say this, but we've put together a team of people who are the best in the world at what we do. And what we do is very niche. You know, we write it's niche within a niche. Like most people don't know what Dungeons and Dragons is. And then we're like, well, we make books. Oh, what kind of books? Well, you mean like Game of Thrones? Yeah, why not? Yeah, sure. Yeah. And we've, you know, there's 11 of us now, and we are tilting forwards at an incredible degree. And we're trying to do our absolute level best to remain treating each other like humans. Because we never got into this business to make money. As I've always said, there's a lot of easier ways to make money than writing role-playing games. Not for me, I'm unemployable. But for everyone else here, there's easier ways to make money. And so we wanted to effectively make art. And the way you can make art ethically is to, there's lots of ways to do it, but we figure it's to get it out to as many people as possible and try and write games which resonate with people and try and write games which make people have these electric times together. And by bringing more people on, we can do more of that. So you know, we've got a Heart Source book, our first full-length Heart Source book, a scant 4 years after release. We're expanding the die line. And so Chan Evans is heading up these really horrible things that Chan's producing. It's fascinating. So I know you've played a lot of die on the sister podcast to this one. Kieran was really reining it in on the core book, and we held him back a lot on how unpleasant and psychosexual everything should be, and now we've got this sort of short format trade comic size things with three scenarios in, and the idea is that each one is one by Kieran, two by other authors. Yes, I can see Brian's holding up Dice Scenarios 1. So Laurie O'Connell in Dice Scenarios 1 wrote a scenario about effectively a corrective camp for troubled teens, where the Fey realm of Die starts encroaching. We wrote it, we put it past sensitivity readers, and we edited it. We're like, yeah, this is fucked up, but it's not as fucked up as Kieran, so that's fine. We can make it work. So I did that. And we handed over Laurie's copy to him at UKGE. And he came back to us the day after and he said, I've just read through this. This is horrible in print. I can't believe I did this. It didn't seem real when it was in the Google Doc. And we're trying not to be edgy, but we're trying to make sure that our heart's in the right place. And there's always going to be a bit of edge, I think. You know, Spire's a little bit edgy, heart's a little bit edgy. But we're trying to make sure that what we're doing is about something, and there's real heart in this. And die, and the die scenarios, I don't have time to run the die line and do hollows, but Chant sure as hell does. And so, and Chant's been running the hollows team as well. And so someone's been telling me what to write, which is usually refreshing rather than me having to remember. And it's great. You know, we're currently making games and we're supporting a bunch of people's careers. And I get to do my dream job, which is to write about elves all day. And sure, you know, it's not, there's a bunch of management duties, there's a bunch of strategy stuff, because this is a business and we exist in a wider world, and so we have to think about stuff like that. But thankfully, I've lucked into, and Maz has hired a bunch of people who are good at that, and so I get to be at least performatively stupid. And get away with writing books for a living. And thankfully, I'm quite good at that. So it's all working out.
I do have to real quick tell you about a die scenarios pitch that our Discord collectively came up with, tentatively titled No Kill Shelter. And it takes place entirely in a animal rescue house, and all the classes are now, instead of the dictator, it's the ductator.
Okay.
The drool instead of the fool, the Amyotian knight, the Neopet, the dog binder.
You lost me, but you had me back at Dogbinder.
I think Dogbinder might have been the first one.
Dogbinder was the first one.
And, oh, some and of everything else fell out of it.
I think Neopet I like, but
I got to say, like, when you said like a no kill shelter, I was thinking it would be it gives me an idea for a die campaign. You know, all those characters in games that you didn't finish. What if they're waiting?
Oh, that's good.
And they're really mad at you that you didn't.
Yeah, they're really mad at you, and they are you.
Right, right.
There's something fun there.
That's good.
Hell yeah.
So our last question we ask every guest is, what are you bringing to the table? And this is just our cute way of asking for a recommendation for the listener that you would want them to check out right now. This could be a person, a game, a show, a resource. It could be tabletop related, or it could be just something you like in the world right now.
Scones. I can't stress this enough. I've been dreadfully depressed for most of my life, but there came a turning point a few years ago, and I realized that my goals were too high, my aims too lofty, and what I needed to do was live to the next scone. And so, because I know that you Americans have biscuits or what have you, and a scone is basically a cold biscuit with a slightly different composition, but it is a sort of buttery, short bread cake with sugar and raisins in it. And the way you have them is you cut them in half and you put butter on it, and then you put raspberry or strawberry jam, and then you put clotted cream on top of that. And you sit in a garden and you fight off the wasps and you drink a cup of tea, and you realize that maybe it's worth hanging on for the next scone, because there are a few things as transcendental as the salt and the butter and the sugar and the cream and everything coming together in that moment. So, yeah, scones, they're better than killing yourself.
Thank you, Grant Howitt, for joining us at the table today. Do you want to let the people know where they can find you online?
I can find G.S. Howitt, 2 T's, pretty much anywhere, but you can find me. It's not too hard.
Awesome. And be sure to check out Hollows on Backer Kit.
Please.
Very excited for that game. And that little special edition components kit is catching my eye.
It's pretty fancy, isn't it?
I might make a financially irresponsible decision and grab it. And if you want more gaming content from us, please check out the 20-sided newsletter and the many-sided media Discord, where you can come and chat about this conversation. Please rate, review, and follow Talk of the Table wherever you get your podcasts. And that's what the table is talking about. Bye-bye, everybody.